frost on the windshield and all, president of SIU, Randy Dunn, joining us in the studio. First off,
good morning.
You bright-eyed and bushy-tailed today.
I'm ready to go.
You know, and I got to tell you, there's always this surprise. And when I was reading on Sunday or Sunday night, I guess, getting ready or some night this week, I know I was getting ready for work. I was, I think, a little surprised when I saw that the Senate president had from the faculty had sent out her resignation.
Yes.
And via email and talked about a crisis of trust. And this is once again tied up into reorganization. And
yes, it is.
Who supports it? Who doesn't
support it?
And all the connotations that are in between.
That's right. That's right. No, I was somewhat surprised to see that announcement, although I know it's been a stressful year for everyone on campus, kind
and
of sorting.
Frustrating.
Yeah. I'm sure it has been for everyone, no matter where you are on the reorganization question. And again, I haven't talked with Faculty Senate President since her announcement, but I'm sure it was, you know, difficult trying to be the presider for that constituency body on campus and move things forward in a discussion. And, you know, it may be the point where she felt her effectiveness had, you know, run as far as it could. I'm really not taking any kind of position on this, you know, crisis of trust issue. What I'm hearing is everyone's engaged in the discussion. People are saying what they need to say. Nobody's getting shut out. And what needs to go on through this process is going on. It's intense, I think it's fair to say. People are, you know, really advocating their opinions in a pretty strong way. But again, as we were talking before we went on the air, every place has its processes, its ways that get things done. And this notion of shared governance is like a checks and balances. Public universities are, to some degree, democratic institutions, and shared governance, which involves faculty, staff, students, is to ensure that the decisions get made to move forward the organization have been fully vetted out and are the right ones to take the university into the coming years. So people get uptight about, you know, all that's going on around this plan.
Well, let's talk about that for a second.
But it needs to take place if it's going to have sufficient buy-in to move forward at the end of the day.
Let's take a look at those two elements you just
used
in your summation. You know, that first off, there's people impatient in the business community to see this because
of
the fear of the unknown.
Because they're worried. They're looking for someone to save the university. But that's not how it works. And as I see business leaders, civic leaders, and others
who are
very concerned about the future of the university, and rightly so, I understand that, make an assumption that it's run like a private business where someone comes in and says, this is going to be my plan moving forward, and it's instituted and life goes on. That's not the way it works. We're in a process that's been, it's not an easy process. In fact, I would suggest fairly complicated, but it's laid out. It's clear. We know what the steps are. It is being worked at this time in the way it has been set forth to work. And if there is the support and the buy-in for these plans, and, you know, we talk about the reorganization plan for the campus. It's really something like, I think the latest count is 20 individual proposals. It's not one grand omnibus plan. It's not one big design that there's then an up or down vote on by the board and the Board of Higher Education. This is really
a spectrum.
This is comprised of, again, roughly 20 or so individual proposals that are making their way, each being reviewed by the impacted faculty. From that point, it will go to the constituency bodies of the university, Faculty Senate, Graduate Council. We'll see what those results are. Just because it may not be fully supported doesn't kill it. It ultimately can go to the Board of Trustees and then to the Board of Higher Education. So again, it's a complicated process, but it's laid out. It's clear. It takes time. It's not going to take 3 or 4 years. It's going to be basically this, you know, this 9 months of the academic year, and then we're going to see what there's support for and what there's not and move forward.
It's interesting. You know, I was down in the middle of the woods, and this has been a couple of years back, and I run into a guy at a winery, and it's a weekday, so because that's when I get off in the afternoons, and I notice he's standing there, and I'm like, so where y'all from? And he says, I'm from France. And I was like,
oh,
boy, you know, I really don't like people from France. And he goes, neither do I. I'm from Corsica. And off we went. We became friends. We went off to Buffalo Rock.
I could see how that day went.
And he's a professor.
Oh, no kidding.
And he's written a book called When the Heart of America Was French, about all the towns, Prairie du Rocher, and
course,
all that stuff.
Of course, of course.
And I got the chance to sit and hang out with this guy for like 4 or 5 hours, a French academic. And he's come here to do research for another book. He says, I'll give you a book, but it's in France. It's French. I'm like, oh, well, you know, thanks anyway. He autographed it for me. It was nice. And he says, you know, Americans, very interesting academics, when they come to our country to do research, he says, what American academics does better than anybody else in the world is they specialize. They know they have this little thing they do, and they obsess, and they do it very, very well.
Yes.
He says, where our academics are a bit more broad. It's taken me a long time to process this, and this, I'm getting to a point here, please, I promise you. And I think what happens when you specialize to the extent that Americans do through his depiction of us, outside looking in,
yes,
that you develop a keyhole,
yes,
that you look through for with your expertise. And when you do that, you begin to limit the broader picture, its impacts. And we become so accustomed. I envision a committee of SIU faculty as a big circle with doors, and each one has a keyhole looking into the center. And sometimes they don't see the other doors or the other point of perspective.
Where do I start with that, Tom? I mean, there is always the challenge in a big, complex organization where lots of people do different things that you're only feeling a certain part of the elephant, right? And everyone knows that old story. The blind man figures out what
the
elephant looks
like
depending on what part you feel.
Right.
So there's a little bit of that. But, you know, to one point, and I totally agree with your French academic, this is not something unique to SIU. In the world of academia in the United States, in many countries, but particularly in North America, the way you make your bones as a scholar and researcher, which our professors are, is to have that narrow slice of expertise that nobody else in the country has. And you dive into that keyhole and you become the national or international expert on it. And again, that's how you make your bones. We're in the season now where we're tenuring and promoting our professors. And the way they get to that point is to show that they reach that level of expertise and excellence. So the system kind of augurs for that.
It creates
it. If you're going to make it in the world,
right.
And the way you get that tenure and promotion is that your other experts in the world say you've got enough bones, bona fides, to have that promotion. So they're working in the system. But to your point, I do think it's a challenge when you pull these disparate groups together to do collective decision making, to think about the larger good of the university, to look at a broad direction going forward. But do give our folks a little credit, Tom, because I run into 90% of the people all over campus. They get it that what we have is not sustainable
but
and it's got to be addressed.
If I'm the guy looking through the keyhole,
yes,
and you say, hey, you're not seeing the bigger picture, you guy looking through the keyhole, I'm going, that's because that's Randy's job.
Well, you get a little bit of that, but I still come back to this. I think that the large majority of that campus, whether you're talking to students, faculty, it doesn't matter, understands that the model that SIU Carbondale has is not sustainable. And this is where I come back to the reorganization plan a little bit. And I've shared this with numerous people, so it's nothing that you wouldn't expect. It doesn't, so there's huge vested importance in a plan to change the model, right?
Right.
But for me, it really doesn't matter the nature of the model. So Chancellor Montemagno comes, he moves forward with a certain type of reorganization plan that we've been looking at on the campus now since he's been here these past 7 or 8 months or so. Another person hired could have come with a different plan. Someone else may have come in and really focused at the start on building enrollment and financial sustainability before taking on a full-scale reorganization. Each chancellor could take a different approach. Here's where I am. It doesn't matter the nature of the plan or how we reorganize or what the model is that's chosen. if this doesn't ultimately lead to a growth in enrollment and increased financial sustainability of the campus and SIU Carbondale's ability to go back to fulfilling its mission as the steward of the Southern Illinois region, and I'm talking here, Tom, I'm talking 20 to 25 counties, to fulfill that role which we've had since its founding, I don't care how pristine, elegant, and perfect a plan is. If it doesn't get us to those outcomes, and I'm talking in about a year,
right,
then it doesn't matter.
It's interesting because I've actually had that conversation with advertisers. Hey, make write me an ad that's really funny. Well, shouldn't we write an ad that really works?
That's right. That's right. So that's the plan is a vehicle to get to those things that Carbondale has to do. That's
bottom
right.
Bottom line. University of Wisconsin discussing the idea of eliminating degrees in English and history.
Now I got a bone to pick with you on this, too.
I figured you might. Because they don't lead to clear career pathways.
Okay, so first, because I heard you teasing the story in your bit before the 8 o'clock hour. I think that was one of the regional campuses, University of Wisconsin Superior. I don't think it was the Madison campus. I think it was one of the smaller regional campuses up in Superior, Wisconsin. They're in many of the same problems that SIU Carbondale is. They probably got too many majors for too few students, trying to figure out how you right-size the campus, maybe pare down the inventory a little bit. So they're going to look at these things.
Isn't that a bottom-line issue, too?
That's a bottom-line issue. I will say this, because then you had, and it's okay, you know, I'm teasing you. You had a little comment about liberal arts majors. Look at you. You had a comment about liberal arts. I'm not one, right? I studied education, but liberal arts majors then having to do, you know, McDonald's and Starbucks. I do say this, I give this recommendation to parents all the time. If the kid comes in, I say kid, young man, young woman, kid comes in with a passion to study history, study music, study whatever, okay, fine. I'm okay to let the kid follow that passion. Maybe I'm not going to pay $50,000 a year for that kid to go to Harvard to study that passion.
Right.
But okay, let the kid study that discipline, go after that passion. The challenge there becomes, are we as a university adding value to that young man or young woman for career purposes? Teaching teaming skills, talking about the so-called soft skills that you have to have to be a good employee, having critical analysis in terms of the use of information, having the ability to communicate clearly, whether it's in spoken form, written form, having a strong command of technology, having a person who comes out with a degree being culturally competent. If we can do all of those things as a result of the university education, that history major or art major, they are going to get jobs.
There is a richness in life that is added by liberal arts that you don't get any other way.
I know you know this. So I was kind of jerking your chain, but for listeners, you're absolutely on the money. And the students that have that rounded set of I'm going to call them employability skills,
yes,
or whatever, and are prepared to be good contributing citizens, they're going to do okay.
I call it the difference between love and lust. One perpetuates the species, one makes the species worth perpetuating.
Yes, yes.
It's kind of like the yin-yang, right?
Yes.
Because there is, and I'm really a linear, nuts and bolts, science, research kind of guy. Yes. I love that. But then I realize, where do I go when I don't want to do that? I go to music.
Yes.
I go to art. I go to photography. I have my own thing.
That's the richness
of life. And the
reason
why is because I had teachers that taught me that way. Matter of fact, I spoke with one of them on the phone yesterday afternoon, art teacher Barbara Allen, former teacher of the year in Illinois.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And she and I were talking about her Charlie Berger work and the upcoming anniversary of Charlie Berger's hanging, 90 years. So there's my history teacher and my art teacher coming out right there.
Of course.
And, you know,
and so much in life, I mean, and I get your point exactly. So much in life is not linear. If you could extrapolate out every answer, you would just do more of what works and less of what doesn't.
Right.
But it doesn't. And I'll give you a great example of what's not linear. College selection. If it was just the case that you could, you know, have more names of students in the hopper, that you could somehow drive an equation to get more students, you'd take the formula and do it, right?
Yeah,
it's not
right.
That difficult. But so many choices and decisions in life do not work toward that algorithm.
All those different kinds of people.
That's
wanting
right.
Different kinds of things.
That's right.
And then categorizing an
so
umbrella.
So that is
in.
What's called kind of the, or I call it. I don't, you know, this is me. That's kind of the art of life. And in some ways, for what I do, for what many of us do, it's the art of administration or the art of leading a university or right. whatever.
You know, it's interesting how whenever I hear a story, my gut kind of just kicks in all of a sudden, right? And so I see the story. The towers.
Yes.
Not going to use the towers anymore. And you know what my gut says? Great. First responders are relieved when the New Madrid fault goes out.
Yes.
Isn't it weird the kind of things you think when you see that stuff?
Yeah.
And then I think back all the times that I drove by and go, look at that cool thing in the window up there. I mean,
it's
weird because I've got a history with the people in there. I can remember the first time one of the engineering classes invited me to come out and say, you know, we got this new thing called a drone.
Yes.
Where you can fly this thing backwards and you want to come out and see it?
Right.
And there we were right outside the towers,
right?
And that's
right.
been that's
you know
been 15 that's
I,
been 25
I can
years
tell
ago.
This I can tell this story quickly, Tom, because I know you are aware of him. I don't know if you knew him. Many listeners will remember John Guyon, who was at the time under the title chancellor president, I think, of the campus.
Yes,
that may have been
president.
When we had the old titles before we flipped them. He was the campus CEO, and you remember the concern that New Madrid was going to create
right.
this massive earthquake, what, maybe early 90s or something,
yeah.
about 92 or
right.
so. I was a school superintendent. I remember this. Everybody went to school.
I was in charge of making emergency routes.
President Guyon, you know, he was hearing all this. Parents were calling, get my kids out of those towers.
Those towers.
John went up and set up his office up in those towers and sat through those dates. I think it was like December of 92
right.
or something. I thought that was just an awesome story.
I, did,
and,
I like that story.
Yeah, that's kind of the stuff you get to
money
deal with.
Where that, your mouth is stories,
that's right.
Man,
that's
know?
Right.
And that's putting your butt right
that's
there on the line.
That's exactly
too.
Right.
But, you know, it does have its own unique problems, and that's what we're responding to.
Yes.
We reduce
yes.
costs. It's part
yes.
of the reorganization, finding out where we put our resources,
yes.
making the most of the money. We got better places for you to live over here. And if hopefully things go well, we'll stock the shelves again with
That's
other
right.
customers.
That's right. And there are a lot of decisions that are going to have to get made between now and whenever. I mean, you know, we've got the beyond repair and saving old Southern Hills complex that's just south of the towers
right.
there. The question then also, and we've got to get rid of that at some point in some fashion. It's just an eyesore. You've got three towers. Maybe do we try to bring one of those down someday and stay with two, or bring two down and stay with one?
Right,
right now, and people kind of forget this, most of the public universities, including SIU, are still in junk bond status. We're trying to grow our way out of that after the budget crisis.
I never thought about that.
We're
Randy.
Still trying to get up and out, and once we build a track record with some money in the till and being good stewards and all of that, the rating agencies will come back and start bumping us up, as long as we don't have another budget fiasco at the state level. But eventually, as we start to see some of these things settle out and get some decisions made, then the piece my anticipation is then that the pieces of the puzzles for SIU Carbondale starts to fall together a little bit better.
And seeing that's interesting, because that kind of leads me to the next question and the last, because we're running out of time,
as
you and I very often do. You got to worry about this, right? You got to worry about the towers. Then you got to worry about the athletics program,
yes.
you know, the title program there. We got to worry about this, and you know, we got the upcoming spring semester, we're going
yes.
to worry about enrollment, while all of the time tending to your relationship with Carlo Montemagno, tending to your relationship with the Board of Directors, the Board of Trustees, I should say, with the students, with the faculty.
And two other campuses that we haven't brought up.
And two other campuses mm-hmm. that we haven't brought up, and the expansion to a law office in one of
yes,
two communities in central Illinois.
Yes.
How do you do that? How do you keep all that? How do you keep that balance?
Because
those relationships, you know just as well as anything, how important those relationships are moving forward. Because there comes to a certain point, people don't want to look at you anymore.
I know.
You got to tend the fences.
Yes.
Well, when I was reading this book, it was one of the guys who actually did a speech at the commencement, and he was a test pilot. And he said, sometimes you got to fly the plane when the cockpit's full of smoke.
Yes. Well, I don't want to get too over the top about it, but...
That's a metaphor.
Well,
I wouldn't say that.
No, I know. I'm talking to myself, not you. I think it's a good example. It's a notion of having, and I've got people in Carbondale right now that aren't happy with me. They think I'm not behind the reorganization enough, or there's not enough support there, or, you know, I need to be doing more for Carbondale and quit worrying as much about Edwardsville and Springfield, what have you. So it's a combination of things. There's, you know, there's just some, again, this is the over the top, but there's some, I guess, courage about it, where you just, you move forward in what you see as the right thing.
Courage and confidence.
Yeah, confidence, maybe. Equanimity. You can't let yourself get rattled. Self-control. You can't be going out after people and getting yourself.
Not if you're a leader.
Yeah, you can't do it. And then always trying to, and again, I'm just preaching to myself here because I keep telling myself this, and you're always thinking about the wisdom of the decisions in front of you. What, you know, you've got everyone clamoring for one thing or another, whether it's reorg, law school, Saluki Athletics, you name the topic. Everyone has a position on whatever that topic is. So it's also then trying to apply the wisdom in the decision making that goes forward, and in the end, hoping then that you're moving forward on all these fronts. You can't just set something aside. Well, we're not going to worry about the law school because I don't have enough mental bandwidth. The law school needs to build its numbers.
I literally read this in a book last week. If you walk away from a fire and you think it's going to go away, it's just going to be a bigger fire.
No. So you got to focus there. And then when you get that, it's like the plates spinning, to use another analogy or metaphor.
I like yours.
You know, so you make sure the plates spinning and things are moving forward. And then when you see another one wobbly, you kind of move over to that. Not in an erratic, nonsensical way, but trying to make sure you understand those big issues that are out there in front of you and working forward on all of them, trying to keep everything moving. That, you know, that's one of the reasons, it's funny why I try to stay on top of email and phone calls. And I'm better on email than I am phone calls because, you know, I do a lot of that when I'm in
the
car.
Me too.
But because when I don't get them returned or when I don't get a response back, it means somebody's on hold waiting for some direction, waiting to get an okay to move forward. And I hate that. In a $900 billion organization, you can't sit and be waiting for somebody to,